These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled Alexander the Great and the Hellenistic Age, Part 1. The lecturer is Professor Jeremy McInerney. Professor McInerney received his Ph.D. from the University of California at Berkeley in 1992. Since 1992, he has been teaching Greek history at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is currently an associate professor in the Department of Classical Studies and serves as chair of the graduate group in the Art and Archaeology of the Mediterranean World. Professor McInerney also serves on the managing committee of the American School of Classical Studies at Athens. He has excavated in Israel, at Corinth, and on Crete. His research interests include topography, epigraphy, and historiography. Each of Professor McInerney's lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, and bibliography. You might find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Lecture 1, Greeks and Macedonians.
Hello and welcome to our series of lectures on the Hellenistic Age. Historians usually like to think of history as occurring in neat and distinct periods where they can divide up time and look at separate societies as they exist during that period. But of course, history really isn't that neat. But in this case, in the case of the Hellenistic Age, there really is a definite distinction, a clear marker that separates the Greek world of before 330 BC and the Greek world after that time. And the distinction is Alexander the Great. Rarely has there been a period in human history that relied more on the genius of one man to distinguish his reign and the entire period that came after him from everything that came before. Now, in the 19th century, when historians looked at the periods of Greek history, they liked to think of three periods as marking the development of any culture. An archaic period during which that culture began to grow and to develop, a classical period when that society reached its maturation, and then a period of decadence when things began to fall apart. And it was applying that system to Greek history that led the German historian Droysen to coin the phrase Hellenistic. Because in his model of Greek history, which divided Greek history up into three periods, that period of initial growth, that period during which the Greeks were first developing their distinctive culture, was the archaic period. It was the period when they colonized the Mediterranean, when they made the first steps towards democracy, when they acquired their alphabet from the Eastern Mediterranean, and so forth. And then, according to Droysen, in the classical age, the Greeks reached the height of their civilization. This was the age of Pericles, the age of Socrates, the age of the Athenian Empire, of the Parthenon, of Greek philosophy, of Greek tragedy, written by Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides. And in this model of three phases of civilization, according to Droysen, the last phase was the Hellenistic, deriving its name from the Greek word for Greece, in fact, Hellas. This Hellenistic phase was supposedly the decadent phase, the period that came after the classical age when the Greeks were at their height. Well, we still use these distinctions as far as periods are concerned. We still talk about archaic and classical and Hellenistic. But I'm hoping that this course of lectures will persuade you that it is entirely wrong to think of the Hellenistic age as a period of decadence or decline. It isn't the period during which the Greeks lose their genius. Rather, it is the dynamic period of Greek history when, in fact, Greek civilization is spread over a much broader canvas than ever before. This is the first thing that I want to introduce in our study of the Hellenistic Age. It is a period during which the scale of Greek culture is unlike anything that has come before. Prior to this, the Greek world has been essentially mainland Greece, the Aegean, the western coast of Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, and some Greek colonies further west in, say, Sicily. But now, thanks to Alexander and his conquests, Greek civilization will be spread across an entirely new canvas, so that Greek armies following Alexander will march from Macedon all the way to the Hindu Kush, to the Indus Valley, and to the Punjab Plain of northwest India. This is dramatically new. If you think about the modern nation-states, which in antiquity, during which their regions would have been part of the Hellenistic world, one finds an extraordinary list. One could include Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, Libya, Arabia, one could include Iraq and Iran, and what was formerly known as Persia, and also Afghanistan. All these areas now are areas which now, during the 3rd century BC down to the 1st century BC, were brought into the Greek world. They received Greek culture as Greek colonists following Alexander came and settled here. So it is a period that is one of completely new scale for Greek culture. And as the scale increases, so does the presentation of power in the Greek world. Everything gets larger. It is like Greek culture on steroids. In the classical world, the Greeks had used triremes, war boats that had three banks of oars. Now in the Hellenistic period, we'll find naval battles where the ships have banks of 5 oars, or 10, or 15 banks of oars. Everything is getting larger and larger. And it will be a period also where we'll see a great deal of anxiety as people begin to worry about their place in the world, because the old certainties have now been shattered. A world in which people will explore the psychology of the individual in the Greek novel and in Greek epic poems, in which the torment of the individual will be expressed in Greek art, as we're going to see later in these lectures. A period during which Greek philosophers will be concerned with the question of establishing inner harmony and peace as they deal with the anxiety of this new age. And, because it's an age of anxiety, also an age in which people turn more and more towards astronomy, and astrology, and casting spells and using magic to control their lives and the lives of other people. So it's going to be a Greek world or a Greek culture that's unlike anything that we've seen before in the classical or the archaic periods. And looming over all of this is one man, Alexander, Alexander the Great. Now, Alexander's accomplishments, which we're going to look at in the next couple of lectures, would not have been possible but for the fact that his father conquered Greece. And so we have to begin even before Alexander in this, the first lecture of our series, with Philip II, the king of Macedon. When we look at Macedon, we find that the relationship between Macedon and Greece is a highly complex one. It certainly remains that today. At the moment, there is a region of northern Greece, a province of the current Greek Republic known as Macedon, and yet there is also a former Yugoslav Republic that claims the name of Macedon. And so it's still a vexed issue. What is the relationship between Macedon and Greece? You'll still hear today Greeks defiantly proclaiming Macedon was, is, and ever will be Greek. But the reality is actually very complex and more complicated than that. Macedon was a part of Greece, but it was also somewhat distinct and different from the rest of Greece. The Greece of the classical world and of the south and central parts of the Greek peninsula was an area made up primarily of city-states, polis, as the Greeks called them. Small areas centered around a particular city, each governed by either a democracy, where virtually all the citizen men were members of the ruling group of that society, or oligarchies, where the franchise was restricted to a narrower group, say the aristoi, the aristocrats, or the wealthy merchant class in Corinth, for example. Macedon was actually unlike either one of these models, because Macedon was a kingdom located in the northern part of the Greek peninsula, And it was a kingdom where power was not strongly centralized in the hands of the Agiad dynasty, the family that provided the rulers of Macedon. There were, in fact, inland areas, we can call them cantons or fiefdoms, if you like, where local barons ruled sometimes almost independently. These were the barons, the ruling class, the aristocratic elite, if you like, of Macedonian society. You might like to think, I'd suggest, you might like to think about the relationship between Greece and Macedon as being something like the relationship between Scotland and England. Geographically connected, culturally overlapping, and yet in some fundamental ways also quite distinct and different. Now, the Greeks themselves were interested in the question of what makes a Greek a Greek, and were the Macedonians Greek? Well, we fortunately have a guide to the way that the Greeks understood their own ethnicity. Herodotus tells us in a celebrated passage that there were four ways of determining who was a Greek. And in Herodotus's formulation, the elements that made up your ethnic identity were your blood, expressed in genealogy, who was your father and who was his father, the language that you spoke, the religion that you followed, and the customs that you used in your daily life. So let's use these Greek criteria to look at the Macedonians. Well, first of all, on the question of blood, the Greeks expressed their Greekness through a series of heroic genealogies so that every Greek could claim descent from a heroic forefather. And eventually, above all of these, at the very beginning of all these genealogies, was Hellas, the man from whom the Hellenes, the Greeks, took their name. Now, the Macedonians were a part of the heroic genealogy of the Greeks, but they were out on the very edge of this genealogy, as if the Greeks of, say, Athens and Thebes and Argos and Sparta thought of the Macedonians as being distant cousins. Greek, but Greek with a question mark, perhaps. What about language? Well, our best evidence here is from the inscriptions and the many personal names that we know of individual Macedonians themselves. And here we can state fairly safely that the Macedonians appear to have spoken Greek. That's certainly the language they used for their inscriptions, and the names of the individual Macedonians are Greek names. So it looks as if, from the point of view of language, the Macedonians spoke a dialect of Greek. It may have sounded a little odd to people down in Athens, but it would have been intelligible and understood. What about from the point of view of religion? Well, once again, we find the same mixture of both Greekness and non-Greekness contributing to the Macedonian identity. For example, there's good evidence in Macedon that Zeus, the father of gods and men, as he's called by Hesiod, and Artemis, the virgin goddess, who was the hunter and the goddess associated with wild places, both of these gods were worshipped in Macedon. And these are clearly Greek gods. But on the other hand, there's also evidence for the popularity of a goddess called Bendis, who's a Thracian goddess. In other words, the Greeks would have thought of her as being vaguely foreign, not quite the same as the Olympian gods. And there's another goddess called Enodia, a goddess who's normally shown riding on a horse and carrying a torch, and she really has no close parallels in the southern Greek world. So the Macedonians betray their relationship to the Greeks of the south and also to the peoples further north of them, the Thracians, a so-called barbarian people in the eyes of the southern Greeks. And what about custom? Well, here we have, in fact, an anecdote that perfectly expresses the relationship between the Greeks and the Macedonians. The best way that you could show that you were Greek in the eyes of other Greeks was to participate in the Olympic Games. The Olympic Games were one set of what are called the Pan-Hellenic Games, games that were held every 4 years but were only open to Greeks for participation. So if you could participate there, it meant that the judges of the games, who were in fact known as the Greek judges, the Hellenodikai, it meant that in their eyes you were Greek. Now, a Macedonian king, Alexander I, wanted to participate in the Olympic Games, and when he went to Olympia, on his first try, he was rejected by the Hellenodikai, the judges of the Greeks. Why? Presumably because they didn't believe he was really Greek. And so what he had to produce was a family tree that showed that his family, the ruling family of Macedonia, was in fact related to the Argives, so it had a good Greek pedigree. Now, I think this perfectly expresses the relationship of Greeks and Macedonians. The ruling class likes to see itself as Greek, but in the eyes of the southern Greeks, the civilized Greeks, the men from Macedon were really somewhat suspect. What transformed the relationship between these two sides was the career of one man, Philip II, because it was Philip who united the Macedonians and eventually conquered the Greeks, making the distinction between the two almost meaningless. Ironically, Philip probably never expected to become a king of Macedon. The reason for that is that even though he was a prince, his father Amyntas III ruled from 393 to 370, Philip had two older brothers, and both of them preceded him to the throne. Alexander II was the king of Macedon briefly in 370 to 368. He was killed by his brother-in-law. And then later in 360, Philip's older brother Perdiccas III ruled from 360 to 359 before dying in battle fighting against the Illyrians. So Philip probably didn't expect to become the king of Macedon, but death cleared the path for him. The early history of Macedon is a fluctuating story. It's one of territorial expansion when the kingship is strong and when the kingdom is united. But then there is always the threat of invasion from the tribes that lie on the outskirts of the Macedonian realm, the Illyrians to the northwest, the Triballi and the Paiones to the north and the northeast. And, as you can already see in Philip's own family, there is always the threat of internal discord as different groups are vying for power. So at time, the inland regions of Macedon, these fiefdoms or these areas ruled by barons, if you will, were under central authority, and at other times they were relatively independent. And it's this combination of internal discord and internal weakness and external threat that prevents Macedon from playing a more considerable role in the affairs of the Greeks during the classical period. Back in the 5th century, most Greeks would have thought of Macedon as nothing more than a good place where you could get timber for ships. It was marginal to the concerns of the Greeks. When Perdiccas III, Philip's older brother, died in 359 BC, Philip still did not technically come to the throne. Rather, he served as regent for Perdiccas' son, who reigned now as the child King Amyntas IV. Philip soon killed his nephew, though, and took over establishing his own family as the ruling family of Macedon. His early reign was taken up with establishing his authority by making firm the borders of Macedon. He was involved in warfare with the three major tribes on the outskirts of Macedon that threatened their security, and the three techniques that he used in order to establish his authority and to end these wars are hallmarks of his success. He uses them repeatedly throughout his career. The three are diplomacy, bribery, and alliance. In the case of warfare, at which he was very good, Philip had been trained in the techniques of hoplite warfare when, as a child and as a young man, he had lived in Thebes. And here he had learned the techniques which he applied to the heavily armed battalion of Macedonian soldiers known as the phalanx. This phalanx, made up of thousands of men, tightly packed, each holding an 18-foot-long pike, required extraordinary attention to detail and drilling constantly. But it was an almost impossible task to face the phalanx and to resist its attack if it hit on open ground. And it was by training this army, this national army, that Philip really established his later successes. At the same time, in some instances, he simply found that it was easier to buy off his opponents. And so his reign began with him going massively into debt as he spent vast amounts of money to buy peace with the northern tribes. And when conquering them in war or buying them off with a bribe didn't work, he married their daughters. And so we find that Philip, during his career, ended up with something like 9 wives. Not consecutively, like Liz Taylor, but rather all at once, establishing a great deal of peace and harmony, no doubt. After securing the western and northern borders of his kingdom, Philip's ambitions turned south and east. And this was an ominous development for the Greeks because south of Macedon lies mainland Greece. Once he'd captured the gold mines of Mount Pangaeon, which lie just on the eastern edge of Macedon, he found himself equipped with an extraordinarily rich supply of gold and silver with which he could pay for the training and equipping of a large national army. And it was with this army that he was able to embark on a series of campaigns in the first region of Greece, the three-pronged peninsula that sticks out into the Aegean on its northwestern corner, known as Chalkidiki. And here he came up against Greek towns such as Torone, Olynthus, and Amphipolis. Olynthus, for example, he leveled to the ground after he'd captured it. His attack on Amphipolis brought him into conflict with the Athenians, because the Athenians regarded Amphipolis as their own colony. And so it was now, for the first time, that the Athenians began to pay close attention to Philip's ambitions in the Aegean and in Greece in general. His thirst for expansion was endless. People have sometimes asked me what I think Philip was aiming at, and historians often wonder what exactly was his goal. I don't believe that Philip had a concrete goal. He really simply wanted to get more and more power and territory. That is all that is needed to explain the endless campaigning of Philip II and his Macedonians. His expansion was relentless. Eventually, it took him across the northern coast of the Aegean, across through Thrace, all the way to the Hellespont, the Dardanelles, the strip of water that separates Europe from Asia. And as well, not only campaigning east of Macedon, but south, he marched into Thessaly, where he intervened in a civil war, and after establishing peace in Thessaly, was able to take over as commander-in-chief of the Thessalian forces, the Targos, as the Thessalians called it. Philip's move into southern Greece, bringing him against Athens and the states of southern Greece, came as a result of the Sacred War, a war that lasted from 357 to 346 and which was precipitated by the attack on Delphi, the holiest shrine of Greece, when it was seized by the people of Phocis, the neighbouring tribe that lived around Delphi. Philip marched south. He used the capture of Delphi as a pretext, proclaiming himself a liberator who, as head of the Thessalian forces, rather than as Macedonian king, would march south and set free the god's sanctuary. This march south came in 350 BC, and the Athenians were mightily alarmed. They knew that a large army of a Macedonian phalanx and Thessalian cavalry marching into central Greece could keep on marching all the way to Athens and into the Peloponnese. And so, heroically, they sent a force to Thermopylae, that hallowed spot where 130 years earlier the forces of the Spartans had held up the advance of the Persians. And in this bottleneck at Thermopylae, the Athenians set up a garrison and prevented Philip from marching any further south. He, this time, retreated. He did not give battle. But he retreated, as he said, like a battering ram, to strike all the harder the next time he came. This second occasion came in 346 BC when he marched south and he seized both Thermopylae and Delphi at the same time. The Athenians recognized that they had been outmaneuvered, and Demosthenes began frantically trying to raise an alliance of the various Greek states against Philip. And once again, he outfoxed everyone's expectations and withdrew, leaving Delphi, as he'd said, liberated. And so we go into a period of a kind of hiatus from about 346 for the next 8 years as Philip campaigns further in the north and in the east. But then in 338 a war broke out, the Fourth Sacred War broke out around Delphi, and once again Philip marched south, once again he came to Thermopylae, but this time he didn't march on to Delphi, he marched into the plain of Chaeronea, heading towards Athens. And it was here that the Athenians, joined by their Theban allies, marched to the plain on the western side of Thebes at Chaeronea. And in 338, in a battle between the force of the Athenians and the Thebans on one side, and the Macedonian phalanx on the other, the Greeks were defeated, and Philip and the Macedonians were victorious. The Battle of Chaeronea, the last day on which the Greeks would be free until the War of Independence against Turkey in the 1820s AD. A long period of subjugation coming up. On this day at Chaeronea, when Philip was victorious, he commanded the right wing, and on the left wing was his 16-year-old son, Alexander, clearly the heir designate, the man who would take over from Philip after his death. Now, what came next for Philip was an attempt to pacify the Greeks who he'd just conquered. Rather than rubbing their nose, in his victory and proclaiming himself king of Greece, instead he convened a convention of the Greeks at Corinth. And here he established a new league, a Hellenic League. So very carefully he was trying to position himself as the leading man of Greece, but he did not claim royal authority. Instead, he proclaimed himself the captain general of the Greek forces. Greek forces for what? For a campaign against Persia. For 130 years, the Greeks had hated the Persians because of the Persian sack of Athens and because of the invasion of Greece. And for 130 years, Greek intellectuals had recognized that in the world of Greece, where every state was out for itself and where warfare continued year after year, the one thing that united the Greeks was their hatred of Persia. In the 370s, a Greek intellectual named Isocrates wrote to Philip and actually invited him. Isocrates wrote to Philip asking him to take on the role of captain general of the Greeks. And other Greek philosophers such as Plato had tried to make men like King Dionysus of Syracuse think of themselves as philosopher kings who would lead the Greeks to a new age of unification. And so Philip had learnt his lesson well, recognizing that he should not try to conquer the Greeks and force them to his will, but rather appeal to them, appeal to the one thing that would unite them and would take them off on a new grand quest. This time, what he proposed was nothing less than an invasion of Persia. And so after 338, we actually find the Macedonians continuing their preparations for war, even though they've pacified all of Greece. But these preparations for war take place on the other side of the Hellespont, as the advanced forces of Philip's army actually claim a portion of Asia Minor as the beachhead for what is coming, the invasion of Persia by the Macedonian forces. And yet, when that invasion is just on the brink of occurring, when Philip is about to change everything and to go from being a Macedonian king and the conqueror of the Greeks to being the captain general of this invasion army, he's cut down. He's celebrating a festival back in Macedon. He has just had 12 statues of the Olympian gods brought in to the theatre, with a 13th statue following, a statue of Philip himself, as if he is claiming some kind of semi-divine status. And now, at the very peak of his glory, just as he is ready to embark on the next great stage of his military career, he is assassinated. People would love to know by whom. Well, we have the name of the actual assassin, but the assassin and his accomplices were cut down virtually straight away, leaving people to speculate a great deal afterwards about who it was that assassinated Philip and exactly why. I'll give you a clue. Many people think that the person who gained most from this was Alexander. And so it's quite possible that Alexander's career, which would take up exactly where his father's had left off, was the result, in fact, of yet another one of the internecine disputes, of one of the feuds within the Macedonian royal family. From such inglorious beginnings, however, would erupt the campaign of Alexander, which would take a Macedonian and Greek army across into the realm of Asia Minor before heading further east and south as far as Egypt, and then across through the Persian Empire, conquering the great king of Persia and eventually establishing Greek culture as far away as India. It would take Greek culture from Athens to Afghanistan, and yet it would be built on the lack of independence back in Greece itself. And so we begin the Hellenistic Age then with an irony. It is a world built on the glories of Greek culture at the very time when Greece itself is losing its political independence. And it is going to be a story in which the same kinds of ambiguities exist throughout. Will Greek culture reach all levels of the world that it conquers? No. Instead, I'm going to be arguing that there is very little fusion between the Greek culture brought by Alexander's armies and the native cultures that already existed. In fact, I'm going to suggest to you that there is no fusion at all in this world, but rather a thin overlay of Greek culture at the very top. Quite frankly, if you were a Syrian peasant under the Persians, or a Syrian peasant under Alexander, or a Syrian peasant under Alexander's successors, the Seleucids, it wouldn't matter. You spoke the same language and you thought the same way, and you were still oppressed by the overlords that ruled above you. But what would be different is that cities would be planted throughout the Middle East, Egypt, Asia Minor. And these cities would be ruled by urban elites. And these urban elites would become Greek. Whether they were born in Greece, whether they were colonists, didn't matter. But rather, they would acquire Greek culture and they would speak Greek. And it would be this urban elite ruling the entire Near East and Middle East that would bring Hellenism from Greece to the whole world, from the Mediterranean to the Indus Valley. And in our next lecture, we'll begin the story in detail with the story of Alexander the Great.